This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Our news analyst, Jack Beattie, is here with me. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
You know, Jack, yesterday in our daily editorial meeting, you told us all here On Point a story about your mother and the great flu pandemic of 1918, and it was absolutely riveting, and I haven't been able to forget it, Jack. And I was wondering if you could share it with On Point listeners.
Sure. You know, in 1918, my mother was 13. She and her sister lived in Milford, Mass. It's a mill town southwest of Boston. Her father was a foreman at the Archer Rubber Factory, which made boots for the doughboys eyeball deep in the mud of France. She remembers peering from her bedroom window at a horse-drawn wagon with bodies in it, neighbors killed overnight by the flu. "When will the wagon stop at my house?" she asked herself, with what terror we can imagine. She remembered the sound of the wagons and the sound of the church bells, which never stopped tolling for the newly dead. Survivors of the pandemic mention it again and again, the bells. They knew the scourge was over when the bells stopped.
And they did stop? And your mother remembers them when they no longer tolled?
That was the signal that this pestilence, this scourge, this biblical punishment, it seemed, was over.
John Donne visiting upon Milford, Mass.
Yeah.
In 1918. Jack, I got another question for you. I mean, it's such an evocative way of marking, first of all, the tragedy, right? Hearing that bell toll every time a neighbor or a friend around your mother died from the flu, again, the H1N1 virus in 1918. But then that bell did stop ringing, as you said. But how did your mother describe how just experiencing the pandemic had an impact on her or changed her? Because she was 13, you said, at the time. That's definitely old enough to be cognizant of the great transformation of the world around her.
Well, I don't really know how it changed her. I do know this, that she became a nurse. And I have to think that had something to do with it, that she had a feeling for stricken people. She had a ready compassion. She wanted to help. And she must have seen some of that as a girl in the clinics, perhaps at the factory. And I think it may have had a lot to do with her vocation.
Wow. Fascinating, because although she wasn't, obviously, as a 13-year-old girl, wasn't in Europe, in mud deep, as you said, in the horrors of the First World War, a different kind of horror still visited upon her because of the pandemic. Well, so Jack, I'm really grateful that you shared this story, because for many, many weeks/months now, of course, everyone's been wondering, when will this pandemic come to an end? How will we know, right? And the 1918-1919 flu pandemic was the last great, truly global pandemic that washed and churned over humanity. And just to remind folks, caused by the H1N1 flu virus, it infected a third of the world's population, killed at least 50 million people. Now, of course, we're dealing with a different pathogen, different pandemic, different time, and definitely very different medical and science technology. But Jack's sharing the story because we still think there are things to learn from that last great pandemic. Back in March of 2020, for example, in one of our very first COVID shows, we talked to historian John Barry, who emphasized to us then that the 1918 pandemic wasn't just a one-year scourge. It came in waves and lasted several years. So, you know, for we here at On Point, and hopefully listeners who heard that show, that really helped prepare us for what was to come, and indeed what has come with COVID. So it's been 21 months, and we still want to see what we can learn from the 1918 flu pandemic, specifically its last chapter or chapters. When did it end? How did it end? And how did the world finally know, or maybe more accurately, decide that the pandemic was over? So Jack is going to join us today to help us think through that. And also joining us is Dr. Howard Markel. He studies the history of medicine at the University of Michigan. He's also co-editor-in-chief of the university's Influenza Encyclopedia, and he joins us from Ann Arbor. Howard Markel, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing actually gratefully well, to be honest. I don't say that lightly. I am very grateful for how well I am doing.
I'm grateful. I'm above ground too. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what you heard in Jack's story about how deeply his mother remembered the sound of bells and that the end of the bells tolling told her that perhaps the pandemic was over in 1918.
Well, I thought a lot of things. First, Jack, thank you for that wonderful and poignant story. I know it's being written down, and if you send it to me, I'll make sure it gets in our flu encyclopedia under the Boston section. Marvelous. You know, we gathered together tens of thousands of documents for this influenza encyclopedia and to develop the study about flattening the curve. When you ask the question, as you just did, when does it end? Mm-hmm. And who gets to decide? You know, public health begins with the word public, as my professors used to tell me. But really, an epidemic ends when doctors and epidemiologists and virologists and public health people say it ends. When there is a zero cases or 0 to 1 or 0 to 5 cases per 100,000 per area, and that fewer cases keep appearing. People have been sick of this pandemic, and if they're healthy, raring to go out for some time, since at least the summer, right? But we're still, the public health and doctors and so on are saying, hey, wait, we're not there yet, especially with Omicron. Flu is different in many ways, but first of all, there were 4 waves of influenza in 1918. The putative flu wave in the spring or summer of 1918 that we have no virology and it was very mild, so we don't really know what that was. Mm-hmm. There was the 2 major waves in the fall of 1918 to about mid-December, from about mid-September to mid-December of 1918, and then a 3rd wave from about mid-January to mid-April. Flu then very often goes quiescent or quiet when the cold months end. It's hard to know exactly why. Is it because more people are crowded inside? Is there artificial heat that are drying their nose and mouth and cracking it and make them more vulnerable? We just don't know. But flu is not very common in the summer months. So it tended to go quiet after April of 1919. But guess what happened in January of 1920? Mm-hmm. No one talks about it, but it was another wave of H1N1. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty serious in its own right. But then H1N1 stopped circulating because other more hardy strains of flu crowded it out. And it stopped being a problem. But with coronavirus 19, or if you call it Delta, or if you call it Omicron, or the whole COVID gamish here, I have to tell you, I've been studying microbes for decades, and this is the craftiest, smartest virus I've ever encountered. And I know my colleagues will agree with me. Whenever we seem to zig, it zags. And so this artificial concept of waves, which is really a metaphor that epidemiologists developed in the 1930s when describing the 1918-1919 pandemic, what we are now seeing with our much better tools, it's not necessarily waves as a different strain that has mutated along the way, which is really quite remarkable.
Okay. So many follow-up questions to what you just said, Dr. Markel. But let me first start with this. Point taken about maybe waves isn't the right way to describe things, but it's the sort of limited language I have available right now. So going back to the 4 waves, essentially, that you talked about with H1N1 and from 1918 through January of 1920, did it follow I mean, was each wave, was it sort of, was it different in terms of the lethality of the flu virus then and how many people got infected and the infectiousness?
Yes. I mean, I can't give you exact measures with those terms that are modern terms, but certainly the fall one was the worst in case of morbidity and mortality, cases and deaths. The third wave, the winter of 19, was the second. And then the 1920 winter was the third most severe. Generally, flu viruses tend to attenuate or get milder as they go through a lot of different bodies. We were hoping the same with coronavirus, but that hasn't been the case.
Yeah. Well, so important to note that there was no vaccine available for H1N1.
Right. There was a vaccine, but it was for the wrong organism, a bacteria called Haemophilus influenzae. But no, they didn't have vaccines.
Yeah. But you did say, though, if I understood you correctly, that the mortality rate went down for each successive wave?
Well, mortality rate, again, is a very specific public health term. Uh-huh. But if you look at the total number of deaths in the United States over each wave, fewer people died with each successive wave. Uh-huh. Yes.
And is that what we tend to see with noting, understanding that all diseases and pandemics are unique,
yeah,
but is that a general pattern that we can extract from them?
No, okay. No. And coronavirus is surely teaching us that. But you have to remember the leading actor in these plays, these pandemics, that we don't give enough credit to is the microbe itself. And, you know, is it a bacteria? Is it a virus? What medicines do we have to counter it? What vaccines do we have? And so on. So you really have to know your foe before making general rules. There are a lot of general rules you can make, but specifically in terms of fighting it, you really have to know the natural history of the microbe you're dealing with.
Mm. Well, I mean, in that case, though, we have a great advantage over the people of the world in 1918 through 1920. So we'll talk a lot more about this when we come back. Dr. Howard Markel joins us and On Point News analyst Jack Beattie as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I was just dying, and people were dying all around me, everywhere. And they prepared for my funeral, all that sort of thing, and gave me up, and they left me with the curtains drawn around me because it was a plague, and hundreds of other people were dying all the time, and they'd given me all the attention they could.
That's writer Catherine Ann Porter, who was given up for dead as she lay in a Colorado hospital during the 1918 global flu pandemic. She later wrote a gripping novella about those times called Pale Horse, Pale Rider. And as Porter told an interviewer in 1973, obviously she survived, but things were not the same.
The change in my own life, in my own looks, I had black hair. And it turned white during this period, and I was 27 at the time. And everything changed in my life.
Well, today we're talking about what we can learn from the end of the 1918 all the way through 1920 global flu pandemic. What lessons, if any, can we apply to the COVID pandemic now? And when do we as a society think that it's over and life can return to normal? Because that's a different metric than, say, the epidemiological one. Well, William Sardo Jr. also survived the 1918 flu pandemic. Again, that was more than a century ago. And he said, though, the end coming took some time.
The memories were so deep in the mind of those that survived or that didn't get it that they were reticent. I would say to about 1922 or thereabouts, where people were willing again to go back to congregating and to feel at ease in church or in school.
I'm joined today by Dr. Howard Markell. He's a professor in the history of medicine at the University of Michigan, co-editor-in-chief of the university's Influenza Encyclopedia. And Jack Beatty is also with us, On Point's news analyst. Jack, what do you think there in what you heard both Catherine Ann Porter and William Sardo Jr. describe about those long-term effects of the global flu pandemic a century ago, even after people stopped dying?
Well, I'm struck with the word the gentleman used, reticence. That seems to be generally so of the literary responses to the pandemic. Virginia Woolf wrote an essay called On Being Ill, and she wondered why haven't writers turned to this tragedy, to all the death that's happened, and to sort of record it. And she writes, English, which can express the thoughts of Hamlet and the tragedy of Lear, has no words for the shiver and the headache. And that there was a kind of what one scholar calls literary silence about the pandemic. It just simply didn't generate the literary memory, which would, in a way, light our path. We'd see how the bells stopped then, what it was like then to feel this was lifted. All of this is a reticence covers it, and it's partly because, as Susan Sontag in her wonderful book on illness says, you know, she says novelists tend to focus on illnesses that can be used as metaphors. Plague with its medieval aura, cancer with its mysterious provenance, tuberculosis with its rosy-cheeked energy and Dickensian associations. These illnesses, unlike influenza, carry built-in mythologies primed for literary appropriation, but not so for influenza.
Mm. Well, Jack, you've also pointed us to the literary scholar Elizabeth Outka, who wrote in a book about the impact of that great flu pandemic on literature. So we've actually found a little tape of an interview that she gave about this, and she explained why there's far less literature written about the pandemic than one might expect.
The way it was remembered and the way that it was somehow greeted and treated really was filtered in 1918, 1919 through the war. Right, people had spent 4.5 years fighting the worst war in terms of casualties anybody had seen up until that point. And the flu seemed like some sort of weird afterthought, some sort of cruel cosmic joke. And people really couldn't take it in. And I think that that's part of why the flu is not so prominent in cultural memory.
Dr. Markell, you know, we're going to kind of bounce back and forth over the course of this program today between that epidemiological end and the social end of a pandemic. I mean, can you describe to us a little bit more about how did people in 1920, 1921 really know that there was a social end to this pandemic or that pandemic?
Well,
there's
also, by the way, beyond Catherine Ann Porter's book, which I teach every year in a literature and medicine course here at Michigan, William Maxwell wrote a book of his boyhood when he lost his mother called They Came Like Swallows, about the 1918 pandemic. You know, what happened is the question. What happened after 1919? It's called the Roaring Twenties. It was the grandest, gaudiest spree in all of American history, wrote F. Scott Fitzgerald. People were coming home from the war. They may have seen really grisly action. Others were surviving the flu pandemic. And it's interesting, too, by the way, there's a micro level, like some of the people who were speaking earlier of their memories, where they'll be affected because their grandmother passed that story on, like Jack's story. Yeah. But for the most part, people did not write down those things. And the literary accounts came around in the 30s. But the bell tolling is an interesting sign of when things are over, because the bell is tolling for the dead. So when there's no longer any funerals, it's a very raw sign that the death knell has stopped. I found that a very romantic and interesting way to measure the end of a pandemic. But it's really about risk and probabilities and what are people willing to risk. You know, if a person who is, you know, vaccinated up to the hilt today probably is risking a great deal less than a person who was unvaccinated and associating with people back in 1918.
I also, if I remember correctly, the 1918 flu pandemic, at least in its early stages, Dr. Markell, it was different in that people 20 or 30 and below were the ones who were
yes,
dying.
The mortality of H1N1. Usually, the mortality curve of influenza is a U-shaped curve, and it's very high at the two tips of the U, where these are like babies, you know, very small children and very old people. But the 1918-1919 mortality curve was a W, and the middle upside down V, that spike, was 15 to 45-year-old people who were most severely affected and died during the 1918 pandemic. That was quite different. And of course, a lot of people lost their loved ones, not only in the war to bullets, but also to influenza. And some, like Jack's grandmother, was watching what was happening in her hometown. So, again, when you say it's over, you have to be able to say the risk is gone. And so I would waggle my doctorly finger and say, be patient, be patient.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in understanding the differences between then and now, I'm going to ask a series of really basic questions, if I may. One of them is, you said, it makes a lot of sense to me that when that bell stops tolling, when people stop dying, there's a very clear sense that the risk or the threat may have abated. Mm-hmm. Were people in that period from 1918 to 1920 also informed constantly of just the number of cases? Because we almost have the complete opposite going on now for this pandemic. I think everyone's bombarded with information about the number of cases. But we, other than, you know, CNN's death count on that it occasionally puts up, there isn't that same sense of like, and now another person has died. Are we focused on the right metrics, and what were they focused on then?
Well, let's begin with right now. To me, it's shocking that we can have so many deaths every day and tolerate it. 3,000 people died in 9/11, and at its peak, 3,000 people were dying a day of COVID. So this is a tragedy and disaster. Back then, in 1918, doctors and modern medicine was just beginning, and they were promising things with their research and their procedures, but it was nowhere near where it is today. So the care most people got was basic nursing care. They got a bed and they got, you know, warm broth. There's no IV fluids. You're basically going mano a mano with the virus. And a lot of people with flu contracted on top of that bacterial pneumonia. And they basically suffocated because there were no antibiotics. So it was a very bad diagnosis to have. And as Catherine Ann Porter writes in Pale Horse, Pale Rider, she describes the fever and the delirium that she experienced, or her main character, Miranda, experiences. And I dare you to find a better description of fever and flu delirium. It's just remarkable.
Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, she writes of the terrible, compelling pain running through her veins like heavy fire, heavy fire. Think of that. God, what an image.
Yeah. And by all accounts, Jack, the cases of flu I've treated, it is not a normal cold. It feels like your body feels like a gang beat you up with baseball bats. Your head hurts. You're feverish. You're like 104. And then your lungs are really quite having trouble aerating or getting air because you have a viral pneumonia. Yeah, it's a very bad disease. And to describe that, I mean, particularly when she experienced it while in delirium, she must have had a little notebook there, but it's incredible. Mm.
What else should we know, Dr. Markell, or other lessons that you can draw about looking at 1919 and 1920? I think it's safe to say that all pandemics do eventually end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm still trying to extract. This is what we ought to take away from humanity's past experience. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the greatest lesson that we learned from the work, because, you know, first of all, you have to know that public health is a state or local phenomenon that's baked into the Constitution by the 10th Amendment. So the feds had very little to do with it because they had very little manpower. The public health service is basically 100 men at places like Ellis Island or Boston Harbor. And so... Now I lost my train of thought.
It's okay. You're talking about what public health was, right?
Right. In the time, they didn't have much. So you read about vaccines, but it's against the wrong organism. There's no IV fluid. There's no antibiotics. They didn't have a great deal there. And that was true of all epidemic diseases in the early part of the 20th century. And, you know, one baby out of five in the United States in 1900 died before their first birthday, generally because of infectious diseases. Another one out of five of that same cohort would die generally of infectious diseases by their fifth birthday. So everybody knew somebody who died of an infectious disease. It was part of life. Epidemics were also part of life. And one thing we learned most incredibly from that flu pandemic is that those cities that guarded themselves early by closing things down, by not associating with a lot of people and waiting until the coast was clear, did far better in issues of morbidity and mortality than those that did not. And that's what we applied to this pandemic, and it probably saved millions of lives. What we found out both then and now is that most communities are not warm and welcome for a second shutdown. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that. We saw that in 1918, 1919, and we see that again today, the patience level of Americans then and now. And I think that has only gotten shorter in our instant gratification, smartphone, internet world. But people just want it to be over, but wanting it to be over is different from it being over.
Okay, so that was then and now. So Dr. Markell, you just said something that I found fascinating because I did not know. So the willingness for really strict control measures went down in 1919 and 1920.
The second attempts were not nearly as successful. There was a lot more complaints. There was an anti-face mask league in San Francisco where a couple thousand people met in January to protest the mandatory face mask law that they had just enacted. But what we did find out is that those cities that had double humps, meaning they shut down before the cases got too high and you saw a dip in the epidemiological curve, meaning in terms of cases of deaths from influenza. And then when you released the brakes, the cases went up. And then when you put on the brakes, the cases went down again. So we learned post facto that these methods can actually save lives, as annoying and obstructive as they are. And we only pull them out once every 100 years for a really deadly pandemic.
Mm. Jack, what do you think?
I'm struck, Dr. Markell, what you said earlier, that we've kind of gotten used to, shockingly, the nearly million deaths here. And I remember years ago, Robert Lifton, the psychiatrist, writing about victims of Hiroshima, and he spoke of how they dealt with it through what he calls psychic numbing. that you just essentially turned off your humanity. You had to in order to function. It made you harder inside.
Yeah.
It dried you up some, but it was the way of coping. Are we now engaging in a kind of mass psychic numbing?
Well, some of us are, which is, by the way, I always say the last act of a pandemic is numbness and amnesia. What was COVID? What was SARS? And then we go back to the same things that may have caused that problem in the first place. That happens again and again in history. But I think there are people who are numb and just want to go out. There are people, because this pandemic has been so politicized, there are people who deny that it's a problem and may indeed be spreading the disease itself. And then there are others who are still very actively staying away from public places.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Markell, hang on here for just a second, because I do have to just step in so we can take another quick break. We'll pick this up when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about what lessons, if any, we can learn from the end of the world's last great pandemic, the one that lasted from 1918 to about 1920. Yes, the great flu pandemic that killed 50 million people worldwide a century ago. And we're asking if there's any lessons we can learn about what we might understand about how to get to the end of this pandemic that we're all living through now, the COVID pandemic. And I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. Dr. Howard Markell also joins us. He's professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan, author of several books, including his latest book, which is called The Secret Life of Rosalind Franklin, James Watson, Francis Crick, and the Discovery of DNA's Double Helix. We'll have to have you back someday, Dr. Markell, to talk about that. But we're getting a lot of comments on Facebook and Twitter here. David Gifford says, my great-grandfather died of the flu in 1919 in Indianapolis. He was only 30. Dennison Rosenbaum says, about the COVID pandemic, time to leave the house. Life is out there. And then Shannon Shodowski says, from a strictly social standpoint, most people in my community in western Oakland County, Michigan, have already decided the pandemic is over. Once society is done with mitigation strategies, the pandemic is over, whether or not the pathogen is still circulating. Dr. Howard Markell, what do you think about that?
Well, that's exactly the opposite of what I was taught in medical school. So if you don't do mitigation strategies and the pathogen is still circulating and you have in your community 30% of the people who are not vaccinated, as in that part of Michigan, you're going to have spread. That's how we measure an epidemic or pandemic. You can say it's your decision. I mean, everyone these days have the right to say whatever they want, it seems. But that's not how you measure it. And if you're vulnerable, you're going to increase your probability of beating that circulating virus. Mm. It's as simple as that.
But isn't some of the thing that we're struggling with now, which is when we say measure, there are clear epidemiological measures, right? But most people aren't experiencing their lives that way, right? And I think that's the tension here. And in fact, Dr. Markell, I have to say, earlier in the show, you gave us a number, a clear number, which I haven't heard with the same clarity from even leaders now, federal leaders, about what's a number to aim for so that the pandemic can be declared over. If I wrote this down correctly, you said epidemiologically it's over when there are 0 to 1 cases, I guess, per 100,000?
You measure per 100,000 in a population for public health measures. I would want it to be as low as possible. And, 0 to 5 per 100,000. Yeah. I mean, you don't want cases popping up. Yeah. But as long as you have that many vulnerable because they're unimmunized, every time, particularly if they're going out and socializing, they are increasing the probability they'll meet that virus. So you see, we're changing the game.
Yeah.
We keep changing the virus's natural history by doing different things. So if we all go out in public, okay, and intermingle, we are going to change the game once again because a lot of us, not me, not you perhaps, are going to get infected.
The reason why I resurfaced that number that you gave us earlier was actually out of a sense of gratitude because what I feel is missing now is...
I get so much garbage from
I just want to say this because we've had several shows where we're just trying to... People want to know how they will know that the pandemic is over. And it's hard to get a straight, clear answer. The target can shift. I understand that.
Yeah. Let me put on my pediatrician's hat.
Okay.
I've had, 30 years of talking to people about vaccinations of all kinds and have given, thousands of them until I learned the trick of letting my nurse do it so the kids didn't hate me. If you had to have the greatest events in the history of medicine, the top 10, 9 of them would be all the vaccines that we developed. And the fact that we have potent vaccines, not just one, but vaccines against the scourge, which we should have probably been out of this problem a long time ago. That to me is the most difficult thing to understand. This is a safe vaccine. And I think the way out of this, the only way out of this is universal vaccination. And that includes the poor nations of the world that can't afford vaccine. Hmm.
Well, I also want to hear from both of you, Dr. Markell and Jack, you as well, about stepping away from the epidemiological definitions of how a pandemic comes to an end. And again, that social experience of the end. Because, Jack, as you pointed out in the piece of tape that we played earlier from the gentleman who had experienced the flu pandemic a century ago, there was that continuing reticence. For quite some time, he described it all the way until 1922, when people finally felt more comfortable going back into churches and stuff in great numbers. First of all, does that make full sense to you, Jack, given that also we talked about we had the Roaring Twenties come up? Did the roar really come a little bit later than that in the 20s?
It must have, it was fueled, of course, by Prohibition and the aura, the mystique of alcohol that suddenly people who didn't even drink wanted to drink. And I suppose historically you can look at that as a kind of reaction formation to this trauma. But there was something else involved too, and that was that just how awful. The circumstances of death were. People purpled. They turned purple. Ernest Hemingway wrote, "The only natural death I've ever seen was death from the Spanish flu. In this, you drown in mucus, choking. And how you know the patient is dead? At the end, he fouls the bed." Millions of people saw that, experienced that, and they wanted to forget it.
Well, Dr. Markell, what other things should we be thinking about regarding how society, you can talk about it, America writ large or even different parts of the country, is bouncing back even the right language to use? I mean, what was the kind of social recovery that was necessary for folks after people stop dying.
Well, you know, you have to look at it both at a micro and a macro level. Even though it was horrible, and it was, my favorite quote is by Victor Vaughn in his memoirs. He was a physician working in Boston. And he said, they were stacking bodies like cordwood. It was an incredible, horrific experience. You also had another thing that we're not talking about. World War I was over.
Of course.
And the two were mixed together. One's patriotism at home in terms of rolling bandages and public health kind of things, you know, making signs or, you know, to stay away or what have you. That was all wrapped into the patriotic fervor of 1918. People were more stoic about their mental health issues. Psychology was just beginning. So it was very, then they were busy with very, very mentally ill patients. So what we are relying on are these memoirs of people, if we can find them. And of course, if you experienced it, like a loved one died, or your child, or you were working in one of these hospitals, it must have been horrific. It reminds me of the scenes that I saw through colleagues at Bellevue in their ER back in, you know, February of March of 20.
You know, we keep coming back to this idea that people saw loved ones die directly.
Yeah.
They were surrounded by the flu-caused deaths a century ago. So whereas...
What's interesting about 1919 is that although many, many people died at home, only the poor went to hospitals in the early part of the 20th century. But they, in this case, most people were taken away from their families because they were considered infectious. So they were actually being isolated, which is the other side of the coin of quarantine, because these people actually have the disease. So a lot of Americans did not see their loved ones die because they were in isolation.
Okay. Because I guess what I was trying to get to, and maybe it falls short now, is that except for frontline healthcare workers, most of us have not seen, even those of us who have lost loved ones, have not directly been able to, have not seen them die because it has happened in hospitals.
Yeah.
And I wonder... Yeah, I wonder
it's if just
that's
tragic.
Making a difference in terms of our response to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
It's provided that I have only about a minute left with you, Dr. Markell, but it's provided that sort of almost society-wise a comfortable gap between what we think and what reality is.
Right. Especially if you're in an upper class job where you could work remotely, you know, if you're lucky enough to have that. Well, you know, Magna, what we haven't discussed is the mental health ramifications of this kind of an experience. And of course, it's going to cause problems. I would crudely call some of the people who suffer and will suffer mental health issues a form of PTSD, but we might call it something else. But certainly, we're going to have to address the mental health experiences of I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of Americans who lost loved ones. This is not easy. And I wish I had good news for you to say it was over, but they take my stethoscope away if I said it was done. Still be careful over the holidays.
Well, lots of lessons learned here, though. Multiple waves, at least four in the great flu pandemic a century ago, an erosion of willingness to do all that it takes to control a pathogen, but also that these things do end. So Dr. Howard Markell, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan, whose new book is The Secret Life of Rosalind Franklin. The Secret Life, I should say. Rosalind Franklin.
The Secret of Life.
The Secret. I'm going to get it right now. One more time. You can see who needs a vacation.
Now you have to invite me back.
I need a vacation. It's coming through loud and clear on the radio here. But here it is, The Secret of Life. Rosalind Franklin, James Watson, Francis Crick, and the discovery of DNA's double helix. So, Dr. Markell, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a delight.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, so grateful to have you and to be your colleague. Jack, thank you, as always.
Thank you so much, Magda.
All right. right. Well, just to prove to ourselves that even if the pandemic feels endless, things do change and they can improve. So we've been reaching out to people we spoke with back in 2020 to see how they're doing now. In April of 2020, we took a look at what the pandemic was exposing about the fragility of America's food system, an essential supply chain that few give much thought to as long as milk and bread are on the shelves. But with COVID, it was clear that food workers all along that supply chain were vulnerable, making the entire country vulnerable too. Well, Bob Lebon is president and CEO of Lebon's Market in Connecticut. For him, April 2020 was a shock.
Like nothing we've ever seen. Every day you just are going nonstop, and it's just amazing. The response from our crew, they just continue to perform under, you know, really scary conditions. And that's the whole thing, is trying to keep them safe.
We got Bob back on the line this winter, and he gave us this update.
This summer was just absolutely brutal. Between the shortage of people with manufacturing plants having COVID where they're short staffed, and then the trucking shortages nationwide and fuel up, it's like a perfect storm of, you know, complications and frustrations.
The family business goes back six generations, but Bob says it's the people of Lebon's Market that define it.
I mean, words can't describe the appreciation that I have for all our people when they just, you know, especially those first few months when, you know, so many people just said, you know, work from home. We couldn't, just like, you know, the medical people, we couldn't. We had to go to work. People had to eat and people had to get taken care of. So they had no idea during those uncertain times whether they were going to get it, they were going to bring it up to their families, yet they came to work. And it was nice to see the world recognize, you know, food industry as essential workers. And our people stepped up and they're still doing it months later. And, you know, people like overtime, but when you're doing it for months on end, it gets old and they miss their family. So we really just said, just dial it back, do the best you can, and it's okay. I'd rather keep everyone's health and safety and their minds, you know, intact. And we've done other things like associate appreciation days, and we just started right through the rest of the year. All our associates get 30% off their groceries just as another form of appreciation for everyone going the extra mile. For me personally, the most difficult time, it was last October. And my wife was watching the show, The Good Doctor, and they were starting to have episodes that included stories about COVID. And the first 6 or 7 minutes of that episode, they were showing nurses that were in the ICUs FaceTiming family members as they pulled the plug on the respirator. And I see the tears of my wife rolling down her cheeks. And she said, that was me. I had to do that back in April and May. And as she said, I don't share everything I see and do at the hospital. So that was probably my toughest time because I didn't have an answer for her. There was nothing I could say or do. It just, you know, hug her and say, you know, I'm here for you. And I feel bad that you had to do that again alone with no relatives to help be there when that family member passed. So that was a tough time. I'm looking at, you know, what the next 20 years of my life is and what our plans are, and, you know, definitely want to spend time with my family. I'm trying not to work the crazy hours that we all were working last year. So I'm, you know, for me, it's more worrying about everyone else. Exactly. That's been my MO. And as long as everyone else is good, then I'm good. You know, I want to make sure they're taken care of first and then I'm second. So during all this, you know, one special moment in our family is we had our first grandson that was born last December 7th, and he is just a ray of sunshine. He just has brought so much fun and excitement and joy in our lives. So he's just a special little kid and can't wait to have him start running around in a couple months. And his name is Remy.
Bob Lebon is president and CEO of Lebon's Market in Connecticut. We first spoke with him in April 2020 and again this winter. And Bob just emailed us this week with another update. Remy is officially walking and soon to be running around. So see, some great news as we approach the end of 2021. And with that in mind, we here at On Point wish you all peace, joy, and good health. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.